Okay, so we left off in Perek Tes, Melachim Beis Perek Tes. We had gone up to and including Pasach Chaf Aleph. We left off with this cliffhanger, where Yehu had come. We know that Yehu is on a mission to seemingly kill the sitting king of Malchus Yisrael, Yehoram. Yehu had been appointed the new king over Malchus Yisrael by a Navi. By the Navi, who we think is Yonah, according to the way Sefer Malachim calls him, the student of Elisha. And Yehu was told, and Yehu was on his way to go and meet Yehoram. And it wasn't just Yehoram, the king of Malchus Yisrael, that was there, but it was also his relative, Achazyahu, who was the king of Malchus Yehuda, who was also present. Yehoram had gotten injured in a battle, and Achazyahu was coming to visit his neighboring king, and they were relatives coming to visit. You know, concept of Bikur Cholim, whether he had the mitzvah in mind, we're not sure. And here we're picking up the meeting, and again, the backdrop to the meeting was that Yehoram had sent messengers out to try to see what Yehu was up to, and the messengers never came back. It happened once, it happened twice, and then Yehoram decided to go out on his own. And that's where we left off. Pasach of Beis. Vayihi kiros Yehoram es Yehu. And it was when Yehoram, the king of Yisrael, the son of Achav, saw Yehu, Vayomer Hashalom Yehu. Vayomer, he said, Hashalom, do you come in peace, Yehu? The Mefarshim pick up on the phrase, Vayihi kiros Yehoram, when he saw Yehoram, is already that there was something. Normally you would only begin talking to someone, not just when you see them, but when you come close to them. Why is the Pasuk opening up with the phrase, Vayihi kiros Yehoram? Is that already when he saw his face, he saw something was up. When someone is coming for a peaceful hello visit, they have a certain face on, and that was not the face that Yehu had on. And Yehu had a much more, perhaps, a fierce and intense face, which added more concern. And quick, it was upon seeing the face that Yehoram asked him, Hashalom, Yehu, are you coming in peace? Vayomer. And Yehu answered back to the king, Ma Hashalom ad zenune Izevel imcha. What is peace? What is the peace that should go to the promiscuity, the harlotry of Izevel, your mother, Ukshafeha harabim, and her abundant witchcraft? What peace do you deserving? You, the son of Izevel, what peace are you deserving? It's a little fascinating because these two ideas, one, the idea of znus, of a zona, harlotry, and chashafeha, magic, these are not two of the areas that we have known Izevel to have excelled in. Izevel has quite the resume of character traits that none of us want our daughters or granddaughters to have anything to do with. Most of them have to do with Avodah Zarah. So why here? It's almost like you're introducing, right? This is the end. This is when the punishment towards the household of Achav, including Izevel, is going to actually begin. Real punishment. So why are crimes that we never heard of being referenced? So a simple, I think. And just to be honest, I think the question of why these are being raised are better than the answers. So that happens every once in a while. We need to do more homework.
Maybe this refers to idolatry.
Right, so the answer that we can give is that so znus and harlotry, that is a lot of times associated with idol worship. Because if a husband and a wife are married and the wife has a side business of being a harlot, then that she's not being faithful to her husband. She's busy with other relationships. Avodah Zarah is that we have a marriage type of relationship with God, with Hashem, and when Klal Yisrael goes ahead and does Avodah Zarah, we're technically acting like a zona. Again, that's true, and the fact that then it mentions Uch Shafeh, it mentions magic, so the Rambam in his Mar Nevuchim I saw a footnote talk about that, that a lot of times magic was involved with Avodah Zarah, was involved with immorality, that it was kind of all mixed up altogether. But the Tanakh, the reason why I say the question is better than the answer is because the Tanakh hasn't been shy about when it's Avodah Zarah, you say it's Avodah Zarah. When it was the fact that there was Nevi'e Habal, so Eliyahu had no problem calling them Nevi'e Habal and talking about the fact that they worship Baal. So we don't seem to be afraid that we're trying to tiptoe around the issue of Avodah Zarah. So if he wanted to reference Avodah Zarah, he would have referenced Avodah Zarah. Apparently, this Yehu was aware of other activities, and he's bringing that out. He was aware that Izebel was involved in maybe some type of znus and was involved in some type of witchcraft. So he says, what piece is deserving to such a mother, to your mother, and by extension to you? So this is not the way you speak to a sitting king if you're coming in peace. Usually you put in your highness, your majesty, everything's great. So immediately upon hearing this, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Vayafuch Yehoram Yodav Vayanus. He quickly turns around his hands, most probably they're attached to the reins on his horse or chariot, Vayanus, and he's running, he runs away. He begins to escape. He recognizes that this is not a peaceful encounter and is going to perhaps end extremely negatively. Vayomer el Achaziyahu, and he says to his colleague, his fellow king, the Achaziyahu, who's the king of Malchus Yehuda, Mirma Achaziyah. It's a mirma, it's a trick, trickery. We were drawn out as a trick. Now, the truth of the matter is that Yehu did not trick them, because Yehu didn't ask them to come to him. Now, when we see what Yehu does, Yehu had all the intentions in the world. If they weren't going to come to him, he was going to come to them. Yehu was not leaving without accomplishing his mission. And it's a mission that's mandated by a Navi. We would not expect him to ignore the words of a Navi. So as Yehoram is trying to escape, he says to Ahaziah, it's a trick, meaning it's more like a trap. That this is not peaceful, and you know you got to do what you got to do to get out of here. Pasuk of Dalet, v'Yehu mile yado bakeshes, and Yehu fully drew his bow. He put his hand on his bow and arrow. Vayach es Yehoram ben Zeruav, and his arrow struck Yehoram between the shoulder blades. Vayetze hachetzi milibo. The arrow protruded, went through his heart, and he collapsed immediately upon his chariot. The way the Navi makes it sound, it sounds like it was one shot. One shot. Now, we don't know much about the marksmanship of Yehu. Maybe he was that, you know, amazing sniper of his day. You know, they didn't have guns, they had bow and arrows. But right. So the idea is that right. You could say he was so good that he was able to, with one shot, you know, get it, not only strike to kill, but such a shot that it hits him, you know, right, and that it goes through his heart. So chances are it had to do with the Yad Hashem playing a role. And again, this is the beginning of punishment that's coming to the entire household of Achav. And it's coming with the backdrop of all of the ill that Achav did for Klal Yisrael for all those years. Finally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is paying back. We believe in a God that rewards for doing good and punishes for doing evil. There was no evil like the household of Achav. And the punishment here is beginning. Rashi earlier in Sefer Melachim, I think we learned this together back when it was stated, but there was a mida keneged mida element that the Medrash says why he was struck in the heart. The story had, and we had seen this story, the story is actually in the beginning of the Haftorah that we had on Shabbos. The Haftorah that we had on Shabbos, it was mainly about Elisha and the woman who took, the Isha Shunamis, who took him in and built him an apartment, and then the son is revived. But we had that first story. The first story was a minor story, was a woman who had two small children, who didn't have a husband anymore, and she didn't have anything, and she needed help. And so Elisha said famously, "What do you have?" She said, "All I have is a little bit of oil." So he told her to go to your friends' homes and borrow vessels and close the door, and you and your children, pour oil. You'll have enough oil, and that happens. Where was her husband? So we had learned the Medrash there that her husband was Ovadia. Ovadia was a Navi. And what happened was is that Ovadia had taken a loan from Yehoram when Yehoram was only a prince. When Yehoram was just a prince, a son of Achav, Ovadia was in need of a loan, and he took it from Yehoram, the prince. And Yehoram, the wife now had to pay back that loan. And Yehoram was threatening that if she didn't pay back the loan, he was going to take the children. He was going to take the children. It's the representative of having no heart. And so he was punished by having the arrow strike him in his heart. That's what the Medrash explains. And Rashi says that over there in the Psukim back in Perek Dalet, the Psukim from this past week's Haftarah. So immediately he strikes the sitting king. Pasuk Chafei. Vayomer el Bidkar Shalisha. And now Yehu said to his attendant, an attendant whose name was Bidkar. We have not heard of, perhaps it wasn't just an attendant, he's like a type of officer. The Mitzudos Tzion says Shalisha is Inyan Sar, like an officer. So we have that in Az Yashir. We have the phrase Umivchar Shalishav. Shalishav, his officers. So Bidkar was an officer. So he says to Bidkar, "Sa hashlichehu bechelkas stay navos haYisraeli. You should pick up the body, the carcass of Yehoram, and throw it into the field of navos haYisraeli for purely symbolic purposes. Ki zechor, for remember, ani va'ata, I and you." He's talking to this officer named Bidkar. "Do you remember when we were together, Aniva Ata, Es Rechovim Tzmadim, Achre Achav Aviv, when we used to ride Tzmadim?" Tzmadim, the Mitzudos Tzion tells us, is Chavurim, something that's attached. And it explains there's a kind of a weird phrase that's used in Parshas Chukas. In the Torah, when the Torah introduces us the concept of Tumah, and the Parah Aduma removes Tumah and you become Tahar, so it mentions that if there's a vessel that has a Tzamid Pesil, basically it means a cover. It means that a vessel is totally covered and nothing can penetrate into the vessel. So the word Tzamid means attached. So he's saying here, "Do you remember Kizachor? Aniva Atas Rechovim Tzmadim. We used to ride attached. We were part of these chariots that were attached. And we rode Acharei Achav Aviv. We rode after Achav, the father of this Yehoram who I just killed. V'Hashem Nasa Olav Es Masa Zeh." What is V'Hashem Nasa Olav Masa Zeh? That Hashem had given a prophecy. That the Hamasa is the Nevuah. Who gave that Nevuah? So Rashi reminds us, it was Eliyahu. Eliyahu was the one who was the prophet way back when in Malachim Aleph, approached Achav towards the end of Malachim Aleph, told Achav that your whole household is going to be punished. And one of the main reasons of the punishment wasn't just the Avodah Zarah, but was the crime against Navos. The crime against Navos, when all Achav wanted was this to extend his property, and it wasn't him, but complicitly it was him. Izebel had come up with the plan, and so he was held responsible for that. So it was very symbolic to take the dead body of Yehoram and just throw it into that portion of land where the very land that he had wanted. Pasuk Chavav, it continues. Imlo es demei navos ves demei bonav. Ra'isi emesh nu'um Hashem? Did I not see the blood of Navos and the blood of Navos' children last night? So said Hashem. Meaning Hashem had said that. This is mimicking and recalling the Nevuah of Eliyahu, that it was because of the blood of Navos and the blood of his children. V'shilamti lecha b'chelkas hazos, and I will repay you in that portion. Noam Hashem, so Hashem. That the revenge, the nekama, and the punishment was going to happen in the very piece of land that Achav wanted. The ata now saw hashlicheu b'chelka k'dvar Hashem. You should throw the body of Yehoram into that portion, exactly like Hashem had said. Now the pasuk mentions d'mei navos v'd'mei as d'mei banav. So we know that Navos got killed, right? That was the whole plan that Izevel came up with this plan. That they would have false witnesses, and the false witnesses would testify that Navos was morid b'malchus, that he cursed Hashem and he cursed the king, and so he'd be put to death. And once he'd be put to death, Achav would be able to take over the land. So what is it? So we know that Navos was killed. That's a d'mei Navos, we mean the blood of Navos. But what's a d'mei banav? The d'mei banav. So there seems to be a machlokas in Chazal. Either Achav and Izevel actually killed out the sons of Navos, that he actually had sons, because it could very well be Achav was a cousin of Navos, we mentioned that, and in order for Achav to quote-unquote inherit the land, so you have to get rid of the closer inheritors, right? The closest inheritor to a person is their sons, or daughters and daughters' sons, and then if that generation's not there, then it'll go to the father, and if the father's not there, it'll go to other generations. And so in order for Achav to get it, he had to maybe knock everyone else off. So there is an approach in Chazal that Achav did actually murder not only Navos, but also his children. The other explanation in Chazal is that no, but if you kill Navos, then you kill any child he could have potentially had. I don't believe we were ever told how old Navos was at the time. But if he didn't have children, he could have had children. And so it's the potential. That's why there's a Mishnah in Mesechta Sanhedrin that says anyone who saves a person, you save one person as if you saved the whole world. Because the idea not just is the value of one life, but it's that you don't know who the value of life, this person will have children, will have grandchildren, right? That's what Moshe Rabbeinu, the Chazal tell us that when he killed the Mitzri, it says that he looked both ways and he saw that there was no man. So the literal level of interpretation is that he was making sure no one was watching him. But I believe it's a medrash that says he looked with Ruach HaKodesh to see, was there going to be any convert that comes from this Mitzri? Was there going to be any good that comes from the future generations? And once he saw that there wasn't, so then he killed them. Meaning, implying that maybe had there been some good 500-600 years down the line coming from this individual, he might have stayed away from it because there's a potential that comes out. So maybe Navos had no children, but Achav is held responsible for the children that didn't come into the world because of his actions. So it appears that the Psukim never talk about this Yehoram ever receiving any form of burial. And perhaps that's the utmost disgrace is that you never receive a burial. We know how much emphasis we put on the honor that we give to someone who passes away. The person doesn't have to be a great tzaddik. We make sure that everyone gets buried in their, or, right? There's the Hebrew Free Burial Society. We give tzedakah to make sure that everyone, every single Jew, receives a proper burial. Here we're talking about a Jew, right? Yehoram, at the end of the day. But he's part of the punishment is he's not given any burial at all. And that kind of ends Yehoram himself. But that's just the beginning of the punishment. Pasuk of Zion. There was another king who was there. The Ahaziah Melech Yehuda. Ahaziah, who was the king of Yehuda, Ra'a. He saw everything. He saw this. Vayonas. And he ran. Derech Beis Hagan. The way of Beis Hagan gets translated as a house of a garden.
Here it's
a garden house. So I'm not 100% if it's an actual garden house. Maybe it was a place that was called Beit Hagan. you know, you have there's a place called Bayit Vigan. I'm saying, it's nowhere close to that place for sure, because Bayit Vigan is a neighbor in Yerushalayim, and here we're clearly up north in the northern kingdom. But he ran derech. You probably wouldn't have the word derech. You don't go, let's say there's a little shed. You wouldn't say derech the shed. You would say derech, you know, Island Park. You wouldn't say I'm going derech the shed that's in front of the building. So derech Beit Hagan probably is more of a place rather than like a garden house. But since it translates so nicely, I guess it translates. The fact that I don't know if we can infer anything from this at all, but usually if it's some type of term, so we see, let's say, the Metsudos Tzion and the Metsudos David, usually they define words for us. So if Beit HaGan was an actual like house, so it probably would have told us what a gan really is. So most probably it's a place. And he was running kind of that place, derech, on the way to that place. The Yirdov Achor of Yehu, and Yehu chased after Achaziah. Vayomer, and he said, Yehu said, as part of the chase, Gam also haku el amerkava, him also, meaning this Achazi, who's the king of Malchus Yehuda, him also we should strike at to the chariot. He should be stricken in his chariot. Bimali gur asher yivlaam. And as they were approaching the Ma'ale Gur, the ascent toward a place called Gur, asher es yivlaam, which is next to a place called Yivlaam. Apparently that's where they were able to maybe make the first strike. Vayonas Megiddo, and he continued, Achaziah continued to run to Megiddo, but at that point he was most probably wounded. Vayamasham, and he died there. And Achaziah, so within a matter of hours, he assassinated both sitting kings of Klal Yisrael. This is the first, and as far as I know, the only time that both the king from the Malchus Yisrael and the king from the Malchus Yehuda was assassinated at the same time by the same person. We'll read Pasuk Chavches and then we'll talk about it. Vayarkivu oso avadav Yushalayma. So at that point, it seems after he died, this king of the king of Malchus Yehuda, Achaziah, so his servants brought him back to Yerushalayim. Vayikberu oso b'kivraso, and he was buried in a grave, imavosav bir David, with his forefathers in the city of David. So the initial question that probably bothers you is, why is Achaziah being killed? So no one seems to be so critical of this, that Achaziah was also killed, which makes it sound like, since Achaziah was a relative of the household of Achav, and Achaziah was married to the daughter of Achav, and Achaziah, we saw Achaziah continued in the ways, the way he was described, he continues in the ways of the household of Achav, that if you are related to Achav and you act like Achav, then you're Achav. And so he was included under the umbrella of who needed to be punished. It included even the melech of Yehuda, which normally we viewed the kingdoms as separate. But unfortunately, all those years before, they had made a decision that there should starting to be some weddings that took place, royal marriages between the two kingdoms. Perhaps initially you'd have to imagine with the right intentions, but those royal unions backfired because the influences of the northern kingdom, the influences, unfortunately, of Avodah Zarah had penetrated into the Malchus Yehuda, and here the Melech of Yehuda is now also killed by the same Yehu. Now, in Divrei Hayamim, when this story is listed, so it's put a little bit out of order, that maybe it mentions the fact that Achaziahu ran away and he was hiding in the city of Shomron, and they had to go chase after him into Shomron, and that's where they finally caught him, and that's where they put him to death. So Rashi quotes a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin where the Gemara says that, listen, it gives us an example. You don't have to feel bad for Ahaz that he was killed. Listen, this is what Ahaziah did. He was such a Rasha that he left Yerushalayim to go up north to visit his relative, the king of the north, and he took a Sefer Torah with him, and he would never have had the audacity to do this in Yerushalayim, but he took a Sefer Torah and he erased every Shem Hashem from the Sefer Torah. There are a few of them, if you pay attention on Shabbos. And he filled in all the empty spaces the names of Avodah Zarah. So Rashi says, this Gemara explains, that's why maybe he was in Shomron. And he had to be found, right? So the Psukim, it might be that there's a couple of more details. The end result is there, no matter what. The story here and the story in Divrei Yamim is the same result that Ahaziyahu was killed by Yehu within hours, within a day of Yehu killing Yehoram and assassinating both kings. So again, there's not such discrepancy. It's in which location did he get wounded, and did he travel to destination number two while wounded, and then did he pass away there, or did his initial wounds, you know, get him? Either way, he was taken out, and the understanding is that it's all an extension of the punishment to the household of Ahav, that he is included in that decision. So there's one. So far, it seems to be, and it was, you know, I don't think in we don't view the actions of Yehu as being criminal, because he's following the directive of a Navi. What you can view him, he's very methodical. He's almost like he has a list. He has like a hit list of who he needs to take off, who he needs to kill. And his first on the list was Yehoram, the king of the north. Second on the list is Ahaziyahu, the king of the south, the king of Yehuda. Next on the list we're going to get to is none other than Izebel. And the list doesn't stop there. Let's see. Pasuk Chaf Tes. Uvishnas achas hasrei shana liYoram ben Achav, in the 11th year of Yoram, the son of Achav, Malach Ahaziah al Yehuda. Ahaziah was the king over Yehuda. Why this pasuk is thrown in? It seems to be a little out of place. The one approach is that we're trying to stress the idea again that Ahaziah only ruled for 1 year. It was only 1 year that he ruled, which for a melech in Yehuda, there's almost no melech in Yehuda who ruled for less than that. We'll see some exceptions for that, but if you think about the kings that we had in Yehuda, starting with David, 33 years, and Shlomo, 40 years, and Yehoshaphat was over 20 years, and the kings were there for a long time. If you're king for a year, it means you're really bad, and so perhaps that's why the pasuk is thrown in again. Pasuk Lamed, Vayavo Yehu Yisraela, Yehu came to the city of Yisrael. Izevel Shama, and Izevel, the wife of Ahav, the mother of Yoram, who was just killed, she heard that Yehu was coming. And it could very well be that she had heard everything that had happened. She had heard what happened to her son. Vatosem bapuch eneha. She put some type of mascara on her eyes. Vatetev es rosha, and she adorned her head. Vatashkef ba'arachalon, and she looked out the window. It seems, you know, to be a little strange or comical. So what was she doing? So Rashi says that she was trying to make herself look attractive to that Yehu maybe should find her appealing. Not necessarily to seduce him, but to try and seek his kindness, to try and not be punished. That's what Rashi and the Radak seem to say. And that's, you know, she wanted to make her, the nicer she looks, the better the chance that, you know, she could maybe win him over so that she won't get punished. The other approach, the Ralbag says, is that she recognized that she might be meeting her doom, but she was going to meet it on her terms. She was haughty, she was pompous, and she was going to, you know, she was going to look her best, even if it meant that she finally was going to meet her downfall. But she was, you know, going to go out her way. So there she is, she's looking out the window. Pasuk Lamed Aleph. V'yehu ba bashar. Yehu was coming through the gate. Vatomer, and she said to him, Hashalom, Zimri, Horeg Adonav. Is everything okay, Zimri, the murderer of his master? Hashalom, is it all well with you? And instead of calling him Yehu, she calls him Zimri. Now, who was Zimri? Zimri was, we learned this together, Zimri was someone who assassinated a king in Malchus Yisrael. He was only king for 7 days because Omri, the father of Achav, found out that there's this, you know, guy Zimri who's acting as king, and he wanted nothing to do with him. So Omri went, and Omri surrounded the palace, and he set fire to the palace and burnt them out physically. So her reference to Zimri, so it was also taken two ways. One is that she was trying to, Rashi says she was trying to flatter Yehu by saying, you know, you're following in the footsteps of someone else who has, you know, made revolts, and you're a prominent revolter. The other approach, which I think it just speaks a little more, because she chose someone who was only king for 7 days, is that she was poking fun at him. She was saying, "Look at you! You're just a Zimri. You think you're overthrowing the whole government, and you think you're assassinating kings left and right. You'll be like Zimri. You'll only be king for 7 days. There's nothing. There's no mamushas. There's nothing tangible to you to your revolt." And so she was insulting him, which. Well, he was told by a Navi that he's going to be king. So, right. He, as far as we know, Yehu did not sit up at night before he had an interaction with a Navi dreaming about being king. Once he was told by the Navi that he's going to be king and he had the oil anointed on him, so you have two thoughts that come to mind. Either number one, he wants to be king at that point because he wants to follow the Dvar Hashem, or there may be some, I mean, at the end of the day, unfortunately, Yehu is not going to be the righteous king that we all want him to be, and he's not going to be considered righteous when all is said and done. So we don't have to feel so bad talking negatively about him. You have to imagine that when a prophet comes to you and tells you that you're king, it probably goes to your head a little bit. You just naturally, if someone came and told you that you are now the king, and he told his friends, right, in the last parak, he told his friends, and immediately they were on his side, right? We saw that he was a little nervous to tell his friends. He came out from meeting with the Navi, and they're like, oh, what did the Navi call you? Right, remember it called it a Meshuggah, because the Navi sometimes acts a little like he's in a trance. And so he said, oh, you know, he told me what Meshuggahim tell me, you know, like nothingness. And they're like, no, tell us. So he's like, fine, you want to know? He anointed me the king. And they were immediately on board. So yeah, that's also, usually we don't always think about the individuals that we're reading about as people. But he was a person. He was a soldier for many years who finally is being given the position of being king. And so, what his thought process was the whole way through, we can't be sure. The only problem with the approach of the Abarbanel saying that she was trying to like insult him by calling him Zimri is then you have to explain that when she was making herself look nice, it was that second option that she wanted to just, you know, go out on her own terms. Because if she's making herself look nice to try to find favor, the first words out of her mouth probably wouldn't be an insult. So the truth of the matter is, the one who says that she was trying to compliment Yehu was Rashi. And Rashi was the one who said that she was getting herself dressed nicely to try to look appealing. So there she is. She's calling out to him from the window, right? V'yehu ba'bashar, we read this to Pasuk Lamed Aleph. V'atomer, and she initiates the conversation saying, Hashalom Zimri horeg Adonav. Pasuk Lam. And also, it's interesting, just I don't necessarily have an explanation, but she refers to the one that he killed as Adonav, as opposed to her son, meaning he killed her son. So you would expect that, let's say this is going to be an insult. If you're trying to insult someone, you're clearly not trying to find favor with them. Why wouldn't you say what you mean, that you killed my son? There's more emotion there. So again, we could just say that Izebel wasn't, you know, maybe she wasn't the emotional type. We've said some negative things about her. Not so bad to say something worse, but not worse, but also negative. But again, that's how she refers to it. Pasuk Lamed Beis. Vayisa fanav el achalon. So he, meaning Yehu, raised up his face towards the window. He looked up towards the window. Vayomer, and he said, Mi iti mi. Who is with me? He's turning to the other individuals that are in those windows in the, presumably, some type of castle. Vayashkifu elav, shnayim shlosha sarisim. Two or three officials were looking out. And if you recall, he basically did the same tactic to the ones who were sent out as messengers. When he was going to kill Yehoram, so Yehoram sent out messengers, and the messengers came and said, "Oh, the king sent us to ask you, is everything well?" And he basically said, What difference does it make if everything is well? Get behind me. Get back with my men." Meaning kind of threatening them, saying, "Either join me or I'm going straight through you." And so here you have Yehu standing down, talking up to these windows to see who's there, and there are these two or three officers, and he's asking them, "Vayomer mi iti mi, who's on my side? Declare yourself if you're going to be on my side or if you're going to try to protect Izebel. I need to know if I'm going to attack you or not attack you. I need to know if you're going to help the situation or not help the situation." Vayomer, and he said to these officers, "Shimtua, push her out the window." Vayishmitua, and they push her out the window. Vayiz midama el hakir velasusim v'yirmesena. The blood that flowed from her body went to the wall and towards the horses, and Yehu on his horse went and trampled her dead body. Pasuk Lamed Daled. Vayavo vayochel vayesht. He came in to whatever dwelling she had been in. He ate and he drank. Vayomer, and he said, Pikduna es arura hazos, the kivrua. Kind of, pikdu is a language of, pakad is usually a language of remember. But here it gets translated as like attend to. He turns to his men and he says, "Take care of this cursed woman and bury her. Kibas melechi. Because she is the daughter of a king." Izebel was the daughter of a non-Jewish king who married Ahav. And so it's almost as if the just a slight amount of respect to the fact that she came from royalty, again, not Jewish royalty, but she came from royalty, so go and bury her. Pasuk Lamed Hey. Vayelchu l'kvara. So they went to bury her. V'lo matzuba, they did not find from her body, kim ha-golgoles v'araglayim v'kapos ha-yadayim. Her skull, her feet, and her hands. The rest of her body had been eaten, as we'll see, was eaten by dogs. And that was part of the punishment. That was part of the nevuah. If you go back to Malachim Aleph and you read the words of that Eliyahu delivered as a nevuah, everything is coming true. There's a statement in Chazal that she The reason why she was going to be allowed to be, at least part of her body, receive a burial, specifically her hands and her feet, is because she used her hands and her feet for proper things. The Radak quotes that she used to clap for brides at their weddings, and she used to also clap her hands as some type of different. It seems that there were different types of clapping back then. There was clapping for happy things and clapping for sad things. Even at a funeral, there was some type of hand clapping. Again, far into what we know of. Pasuk Lamed Vav. Vayashuvu vayagidu lo. They returned, and they told him. Vayomer, and he said in response to hearing what had happened to even her dead body, Dvar Hashem, who, this is all the Dvar Hashem, this is all the word of Hashem, Asher Diber Biyad Avdo Eliyahu Atishbi Lamor, that he spoke, that Hashem spoke through his servant Eliyahu Atishbi, saying, Bechelek Yisrael, it will be in the portion of Yisrael, Yochlu Haklovim Es Besar Izevel, the dogs will eat the flesh of Izevel, meaning after she's passed. Pasuk Lamed Zayin, V'hoisa Nivlas Izevel, Kedomen Al Pnei Asada Bechelek Yisrael, that the dead, the word Nivlas, that's usually the word we use, the Tanakh, the Torah uses for a nevela. A nevela is an animal. Let's say you have a kosher animal, a cow, that died in the field. So it's kosher because it's in a cow, but it didn't have proper shechita. So it's not edible, halachically. So we call that a nevela. A nevela, so you're allowed to take your nevela, you're allowed to, let's say, to feed the nevela to your dog. You're allowed to make use of a nevela. You can't make use of it yourself, obviously. So usually the word nevela is used to talk about a dead animal. To use the word nevela about a person is extremely degrading, but that's the point here. The point here is that Izevel was deserving of such a level of description that you would call her a nevela, that her body was a nevela. So the Hyisa Nivlas Izevel, the carcass of Izevel, Kedomen al Pnei Asada, would be like a Kedomen is the Metzud Sion says Kizevel. The word Zevel is manure. Would be like fertilizer or manure on the field in the portion of Yisrael. Asher lo yomru zosi zevel, to the extent that no one would be able to recognize and say any longer when any of her remains were found that this was Izevel. But the fact that the parak concludes with this line is very telling. It's telling because Yehu is recognizing and he's acting with the directive of that it's Dvar Hashem. And he quotes, and in case, you know, it's available for us, I won't do it now, but you can go back and read the psukim. It's horrific, and the punishment is something that we're not necessarily used to. But all these three things, except the fact that the only thing that we're thrown a little bit on the curve is that the king of Yehuda was also killed. We were not necessarily expecting that. That if you would go back and read the psukim there in Malachim Aleph, you would think the household of Achav has to be destroyed. So far we've had just the son killed, and Izevel has to be punished. We saw that also. The one piece of information that's kind of quote-unquote new is the idea that the king of Yehuda was also killed. So let's... His whole household, we're going to see that it doesn't... You have to hold on. The list of who needs to be killed is far from complete. We only have three individuals so far that were killed. We have Yoram, the son of Achav, Ahaziah, the king of Yehuda, and Izevel. Oh, so it's not going to be the entire household. It's not going to be the promise for the house of David. You're right. It's not going to be the same thing. Achav, we already said, Achav, there's not going, when he's finished, there's going to be no one with any of Achav's blood left to become a king in Malchus Yisrael. That's true. So, but we have to see how that develops. So here we have a couple of minutes left. Let's start Perek Yud. So we have a separate sheets for Perek Yud. If you don't have, you could pass it around. The Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph. Ula Achav Shivim Bonim B'Shomron. Achav had 70 sons in Shomron. Now, to have 70 sons in Shomron, so you might be a little impressed that he has 70 children. There's another medrash that said, in addition to these 70, there were another 70 in Israel. However, another source says not all of them were actually sons, some were grandsons. That at this point of the game, he already had grandsons. And first of all, that's not so foreign for us. For the Torah to call Banim, Bnei Banim Harem Kabanim, that grandsons are considered sons. We also we've spoken about this many times. We don't get to know everything that ever happened. When it came to David HaMelech, we were told wife after wife after wife, and we're told this son came from this wife, and that son came from that wife. When it came to Shlomo HaMelech, we were told about certain of his wives, and we threw out certain large numbers of wives and concubines. When it comes to the other kings, so far, sometimes we don't hear of any wife. Usually, when it comes to the Malchus of Yehuda, when a king is introduced, we're told who his mother is. We're told who his mother is, so by default, we know who the queen was in the previous generation. But we have to imagine that kings had many wives. So when we're told that Achav had 70 children, it doesn't have to be so shocking, because if he had 10 wives, that's average of 7 sons. So that's not, you know, for all we know, he could have had 18 wives. A king is allowed to have 18 wives. You could also say he's Achav, he worships Avodah Zarah, he probably doesn't care what the Torah tells him about the limitation of number of wives. And then with the fact that it's grandchildren, so then, you know, really anything's on the table. To have 70 descendants, you know, you go to probably some of the families nearby here who don't necessarily daven in this shul, daven in a different shul. After one or two generations, you could have 70. It's probably not even so hard. So again, that's Elach of Shivim Banim. 70 males are, according to the pasuk here, 70 male descendants are in Shomron. Vayichtov Yehu Svarim. Yehu wrote scrolls. Vayishlach Shomron. And he sent them to Shomron. Now, who were the scrolls addressed to? They were addressed to the following individuals. El Sarei Yisrael Hazakenim. To the elder officials of Yisrael. The El HaOmnim, and to the ones who were taking care of the small children. The El HaOmnim Achav. The Omnim, the ones who are taking care, as the Mitzudos Sion says, the Omnim are the Megadli HaYiladim. The ones who were taking care of the small children. It's not uncommon that in a palace, the person who raises the child is not the actual mother and father. The actual mother and father are busy being king and queen, but there's a nanny, a governess, fancy terms that end up raising, you know, I guess, you know, Mary Poppins-like figure that handles the children. So that's who he's addressing. And he's addressing them, Lemor, saying as follows. Pasuk Beis. Va'ata kevo ha-sefer hazeh aleichem. When this scroll reaches you, this is probably part of the text. When this scroll reaches you, v'etchem b'nei adonechem, and in your care, v'etchem, and with you, are the sons of your master, meaning Achav's progeny. V'etchem harechev v'asusim, and with you are chariots and horses. The Ir Mivtzar, and you have a fortified city. The Hanashek, and you have Neshek. You have, that's a modern day word, Neshek. But as the Mitzvah Sion says way back when, Klei HaMilchama, the vessels of war, we call weapons. So you have all of these things. So here's the deal. Pasuk Gimel. Ure'isem hatov v'hayashar mibnei adonechem. You should see who is the tov, who is the good one, v'hayashar, the virtuous, the straight one, the yashar, mibnei adonechem, from the children of Achav, v'samtem al kisei aviv, and have that son, who you think is the best one, the most, the one who's most fit to lead, sit him on his father's chair. What does it mean, his father's chair? The throne. V'hilachamu al beis adonechem. And then fight for the household of your master. If you're going to side with Achav and Achav's family, then find a suitable king from his progeny, elect him as king, put him on the throne, and get ready to fight. Fight with who? Fight with me. Fight with Yehu. So that's the first. That's the first side of the. That's what he's basically saying to them. What's their response? Pasuk Dalet. Vayiru ma'od ma'od. They weren't just afraid. They weren't just very afraid. They were very, very afraid. Ma'od ma'od. Which, you know, normally for those who are critical of grammar, when it comes to English grammar, you can't write very, very, right? If a student writes very, very, the teacher circles the second word very and you know, says that's not necessary. In Tanakh, that's not one of the rules of grammar, apparently. We've seen that other times. Ma'od ma'od is used to show emphasis. Vayiru ma'od ma'od, vayomru, and they said to themselves, and again, some of them were called zakenim, some of them were called sages, some of them probably had some level of life experience and wisdom. Vayomru, they said amongst themselves, hine shnei ha'melachim lo amdu lefanav. Behold, these two kings, the king of Yisrael, Yoram, and the king of Yehuda, Achaziyahu, lo amdu lefanav, they couldn't stand up to this individual. They couldn't stand up to Yehu. Eich namod anachnu. How could we stand? What are we doing? We're going to find another son of Achav. We're going to find a grandson of Achav that we're going to throw on the throne and make him king, and he's going to be able to lead us against this wild terrorist, however you want to refer, right? From their perspective, they don't have allegiance yet to Yehu. Yehu's a renegade, but he's a renegade that is dangerous and that is scary and that is inspiring fear, instilling fear into them. Pasuk Hey. Vayishlach Asher al Habayis. So the one who was al Habayis, the one who was in charge of the household, of maybe the palace, sent back Vasher al-Ir, and also the one who was in charge of the city, Vazakenim, and the sages, Vaomnim, and the caretakers, al-Yehu Lemar, they sent back to Yehu the response, Avodecha anachnu, we are your servants. V'chol asher tomar eleinu, nasa. And everything that you tell us, we will do. Lo namlich ish hatov be'enecha ase. We are not going to appoint any other king. We're not going to appoint anyone as king. You now should do whatever is good in your eyes. So at this point, he threatened them and basically said, you want to stay on the side of the family of Achav? That's fine. Pick someone, put him on the throne, and we'll go to war. Their response is that we don't want to do that. We are your servants. And they agree to be his servants before they find out what he actually wants from them. Which is always a little bit dangerous to do that. On the other side, you're going to say, what choice did they have? So they're already saying, they say two things. On the one hand, they say, Avadecha anachnu, they say, we are your servants. And then they say, anything that you tell us, we're going to do. we're not going to appoint the king. And they conclude with the words of saying, and you should do whatever is good in your eyes. The tactic here is going to be that so far, if you're going to look at the rest of the country, and right, imagine you're in a town that's away from all this, and you're just hearing what happens. So far, you've heard that Yehu, an individual, received a prophecy, perhaps. And again, if you're an Ovid Avodah Zarah, prophecy has it's not as much of a premium as Arya. If someone, first of all, if someone would walk through the door and tell us here to prophecy, we would all tell him he's crazy. But halavai, if we lived in a time of Nevuah and someone in your neighborhood heard prophecy, you'd be like, wow, you know, you want to have him over at your Shabbos table to hear about it. But the average person is going to hear that there's this renegade, this Yehu. He assassinated both sitting kings and Izebel, who at that point was the queen mother and used to be the queen. So you might be thinking that everything hinges on Yehu. How can Yehu succeed in giving a message over to the people that his mandate is not just, not only is it from God, it's not only his mandate, but it's the mandate of the country? And he does that through a fear tactic, by turning all of these individuals who he just contacted, these Zakenim and the child takers, he turns them into his deputies. And they are going to play a role in fulfilling the mission. So that when we continue next time, and we read, after the next act, it's not just Yehu who is destroying the house of Ahav, but he now has at least 70 other partners, prominent, perhaps, partners in his plan of destroying the house of Ahav, which from a PR level changes the whole landscape of his revolt. Because it's not just a lone renegade anymore. There are going to be people on his side. So Bezrat Hashem, next time we'll continue, and we'll take it from there.